Hey guys, welcome to this week's Money and Investing Show. This week we are looking at market crashes, what they are, how to trade them, and things not to do when the balloon goes up. This is such an important area to understand in any trader's development, as it helps you make non-emotional decisions that will help you come up with the right outcome for you in your account. Plenty of notes to take out of this, but don't just take notes. As always, please do make sure you take plenty of action. Hey guys, welcome to this week's Money and Investing Show with me, your host, Andrew Baxter, and as always, my offsider and co-host, Mitchell Laurentia.
Well, good to be here, Mr. B. Thanks very much. Now, my last segue wasn't too shabby, so today I'm going to save you all the pain and misery and just get straight into it.
Thanks for that. It was a woeful, woeful segue last time.
Sorry, not sorry. Today we're going to be talking about market crash and market recovery, the lessons we've learned from history. Now, you're a little older than me, probably 7 or 8 decades older, so I'm sure you'll have some wisdom to share with us today.
Yeah, well, let's hope so. It's a low benchmark to beat.
Yeah, that's right.
All right, enough banter. Let's get into it. So, yeah, market crashes, and I think when you talk to someone that's a potential investor, they always, when you're saying, "Oh, what do you do? I'm a property guy. I don't like the idea of a market crash. It's this terrifying sort of vision of horror as you watch all your money go down the gurgler and never to come back again." And a couple of things to say about market corrections: they happen. They happen actually more frequently than people would think. But to date, at least as far as, you know, the Western world is concerned, markets have always continued to recover to a new and higher level. So it's something to be really minded of. And a lot of people out there that scaremonger with their marketing. There's a certain guy over in the US that's been calling for the great correction ahead. And the last time I spoke at one of his events was probably nearly 9 years ago. And we had a bet at the time. And he said, "Oh, you know, the Dow's going to be at 6,000. And I said, "It'll be at 30,000. And he slows me a case of wine for that conversation. So these corrections do happen, but they don't happen as often as people would think. So if we go back through and talk about some of the big horror stories, first of all, and why they're etched into people's mind. And when you hear a horror story, it isn't necessarily a bad thing if you, number one, know how to traverse it, and number two, know how to capitalize on the after effects of it, which I guess
that's
is
right.
Where you're going to take this as you drive through. So let's start with 87. So the 87 crash was my first experience, not as an industry professional, but as a kid, I had some money saved up and we'd done investing in shares at school, and I'd got my parents to open an account and had a crack at investing in the stock market to make my fortune. And I invested probably about 2 months before the 87 crash, which was in October, and got totally cleaned up. Now, I wasn't a big account holder at the time. I think my account was probably about £500, which was all I had. And it got reduced to about £150-£200, which hurt like hell. And I think that in itself, for me personally, was a very valuable lesson to have at that end of my career, i.e. before it even started, because if you'd have been handed your backside on a silver plate as you're transitioning to retire, which I've seen, and we'll talk about subsequent examples of that in a minute, that's pretty bad news, because you don't have time on your side for things to recover. And it's why in our book, The Wealth Playbook, we talk about getting started today, because you've got time for things to wash through. So the 87 crash certainly wasn't a fun time for me, but it did prompt me to do two things. One, learn about risk management, which has served me well in my career. And number two, learn a little bit more about something before you go diving in. And fortunately, I certainly did that. And I've had my career in this space since. So that was a very vivid one. And I think that was the last of the old school corrections in markets, because it was really pre-technology, where you had, interestingly enough, the seat system that the ASX still use came into effect that year.
Okay.
So it was all new technology at the time that kind of sped things up past what they would normally be. And I think the 87 crash was right on that cusp of technology and information dissemination sort of being more the norm.
How bad was it? The 87 crash, how big are we talking?
Yeah, this is sort of 40%.
Trillions.
That's a bit of bark taken off.
Yeah.
And but very quickly things recovered, you know, in the Western world, if I'm right, you know, you had a conservative government in the UK that steered the economy through and got it back on track. And likewise in the US, I think it's a Republican government there that did the same thing. So things blew over. And on we went. And so, you know, you then take that through, okay, what happened next? And look, go to 97, for example, which isn't on most people's memory bank as being a correctional crash in market. So in 96, 97, we saw the Asian countries that had a tremendous economic run. You know, it was the Asian tigers, everything was off to the races. You know, countries like Thailand and South Korea and whatnot, just going absolutely berserk. And then all of a sudden, when interest rates started to shift, their currencies collapsed and the whole thing imploded. Equally around the same time, Russia defaulted on its debt, PRINZ being Russian treasuries, PRINZs. They defaulted. They said, we don't have any money to pay, because their currency imploded. And so that was a crisis across emerging markets. And that was pretty serious. So if you think back to companies that disappeared during the GFC, Lehman Brothers was one of them. Now, Lehman Brothers almost went in 97 because we, on the floor, we were told from our risk team, we cannot use Lehman as a counterparty. So you'd be trading and the Lehman trader would be there trying to fill an order. And it's almost like you've got a lazy eye and you're just trading the Bear Stearns guy, not there anymore either, or Merrill's or whomever it might be, that was stood next to him. And he'd be quoting a better price and you'd just be, just move out the way, I've got a truck. You just totally ignored. And we weren't allowed to counterparty with them.
Wow.
And they almost went in 97. Yeah, there's a bit of anecdotal sort of proof of,
cool.
of things that can go wrong. And so it wasn't a surprise to see him go under in the subsequent GFC. So yeah, that was an interesting one because that sort of slid under the radar. A lot of people don't know about that. So 2001, big correction, tech wreck. Very specific though, technology. And that was monumental. I mean, you know, the tech sector was kind of like the tulip bubble that you've seen. You know, people put the NASDAQ over that or Bitcoin over that chart and look at it. And that was pretty gnarly. But at the same time, it was predicated on the fact that, you know, you had these valuations on anything that was .com. You know, you could list yourself as Mitch.com and raise $1 billion and, well, what am I going to do with it? There's no business behind it. Mm-hmm. It's just everyone wants to get money into that.
Yeah.
And so to an extent, that was a very hollow bubble. And then you look at some of the survivors of that, Amazon being one of them, that subsequently, or Google being another one that came through that and went on to be the monolithic organizations they are. Now, that for me was the first time I was trading on my own account rather than for working for the bank or in the industry, so to speak. And I was trading from home. I just moved to Australia not long before. And that was really lucrative, that .com on the way up and equally on the way down. That was a really good time to make some good money because it was fast, really fast. And it was totally irrational because you've got people running for the door. And you could literally, I was just on the floor before you see someone panicking or they're in a tough spot. You can see the whites of their eyes, literally just that absolute panic. Brain's just gone into red mode and it's horrific to see. And the tech wreck was very much like that, just bang down. And that was brutal. Didn't recover too quickly either. I think it took the NASDAQ something like 15, 16 years to get back to new highs.
Yeah.
So, you know, that was a few of them when you look at it like this. And of course the GFC, which that was an interesting one because the build up to that was actually really visible. And if you were a chartist, and I'm very grateful to my good friend Jim Bonner, very, very early in my career, taking me under his wing and teaching me charts, you could see the pattern building in before it happened. And that's one of the great things about charts. They're not the be all and end all, but they're very useful from a timing mechanism. If you look at the GFC, there's a perfect rounded top in the markets. You can see those lower highs. It's telegraphing, and it wasn't just over 5 minutes. It was a good couple of months ahead going, this thing is looking very, very toppy and looking to roll over. And then of course it did. And what was interesting, I think, with the GFC, the tech wreck was what it was. It was in the tech sector, but the GFC was so broad-based. It started in the world's finance, you know, banking sector. And Australia was, and a lot of Australians, of course, they've heard of it, but they realized the share market dropped. But we were quite immune here because we just really kicked on with our relationship with China and iron ore exports, which to all intents and purposes meant the Australian economy dodged a recession. Sure, it was a bit tougher, but it wasn't a recession, not like they had in the US. And so we're kind of impervious to that to an extent. So maybe we were the lucky country. But looking in the US, I mean, it was really devastating. That said, even in Australia, what you start to see is a contagion. So it was a stock market crash, but it started to affect other kinds of asset classes. You know, if you, at the time, a lot of people had, you know, mortgage funds that they were investing in, seeking a nice income as a pensioner, as a retiree, and so many of those fell over on the back of that because of liquidity. So that was pretty nasty. And then, I suppose you can add COVID, which was a decent correction, but the recovery.
First one.
Yeah, how did it feel?
Terrible. I remember because I was pretty early on in my career. I had a portfolio of shares that I'd bought maybe six months to a year before that and got absolutely pummeled.
Mm.
And I remember feeling that panic and that, oh my God, what do I do? had to ride through and weather the storm. I remember it vividly like it was yesterday. It was really tough.
I bet you never let go of that feeling either, because even though financially it would be relatively small to anything you might do going into the future, the learning lesson is priceless.
Yeah. I remember sitting down in your office actually, and I said, what do I do? And you and I had a conversation and built out a game plan just like it was yesterday.
It's you can't tell people what that feels like. And it's interesting, in the investing space, we always talk about not making decisions based on how you feel, but you can't tell someone what it actually feels like to be in that situation, because so much emotional baggage is attached to your number, your wealth. And when it's going up the pan pretty quickly, there's no feeling like it. It's just an awful, awful feeling. And it can create a state of helplessness. You're in a position where you had people around you could talk to, as our clients do, and you can iron out a game plan to move forward. What was interesting with the COVID correction is that it recovered almost as quickly as it went down. And normally the old analogy is, you know, markets fall down the elevator shaft and climb up the stairs. They take a long time to go up and they fall very quickly. But COVID was really quite different insofar as it recovered almost as quickly as it went down. It was just insane.
Yeah.
I mean, a signal screener saved the day for a lot of our clients through there.
Yeah.
And I guess the message in there is you've got to try and park those feelings of watching your number get shredded. And it's so hard to do. If you're just about to transition into retirement and your portfolio is worth 40% less today than it was a week ago, well, your income that you're going to earn is going to be 40% less too. And if you did a straw poll down the road out there at lunchtime and said, hey, how do you feel about a 40% cut in your income? I don't think you get too many people signing up for it. It's not a nice proposition to face, yet that's exactly the impact. And there are naysayers out there that go, oh, you know, people that invest in the stock market are rich, they can afford it. But it's everyone that's got a super fund is in the same situation. So
that's right.
It's a common pain that's across the board for everybody. And once that damage is done, it leaves people in this sort of catatonic state of shock if they're not hardened to it, if they haven't had a game plan or risk management in play, and they feel helpless because I'm down 40%, what do I do now? And the worst thing so many people do is hit the exit button at just the time that you should be hitting the buy button.
That's right. That's right.
But it's so damned hard to get someone to flip the switch and move across there, because psychologically you've got this whole weight of life experience telling you that this is bad, and when something's bad, it's time to run. It's not time to fight, because you can't fight the market, but it's definitely not time to run. It's time to be quite strategic and think very carefully as to what your next move is.
Let's talk to that now. So we've covered the crash. Before we go into the recovery, let's talk about weathering the storm during the crash, because there are strategies and risk management techniques you can use to at least partially insulate yourself. What springs to mind for you?
Look, there's the, I always got asked this for an interview I did for a newspaper a while ago. This, you know, what's your best buy, hold, and sell? And it's like, you know, buy a parachute, hold on tight, and sell everything, which was meant as a joke. It was an icebreaker in the interview. I don't know how well it sat, but, you know, you have to have risk management before you enter into something, because again, if you go back to that really hollow feeling, which we've all been through as people that are managing not only our own money, but also those that we look after for clients too. There's a huge duty of care that goes with that. And it's a very heavy load to carry on. It's easier to manage your own money than somebody else's. Yet people on the outside go, it's easy, it's not yours, it doesn't matter. But you actually carry that responsibility in a different way. And so I think you have to have a strategy for what are you going to do if it goes wrong. And you think about an 80-minute run around. If anyone's played any sport, you think about an 80-minute rugby match or a 90-minute soccer match, or here I am 25 years into my time in Australia. How long's an AFL game? Because it varies. Not all
quarters of 20 minutes plus time on. So you should get about 32, 35 minutes a quarter.
There you go. That's roughly the time on they got me, right?
Oh, yeah.
So before you run out of the sheds and probably in the precursor to that game at the weekend, the coach has spent time, you're on the whiteboard, this is what we're going to do, these are our set plays, that's the target, we're going to put him into play, decoy runners, all the different conversations. So before you run out for an 80, 90, 120-minute game of footy, there's a game plan in play. And it's only a game of footy. Not everyone's played elite sport like you have, where there's a lot more prep. Yet most people don't put that level of prep into their life worth. It's like, oh, I'll get some shares. And it's like, well, what are you going to do if it goes wrong? Well, they will recover. Yeah, sometimes.
Maybe, maybe not. Yeah.
Babcock & Brown, Elko Finance, Enron. Yeah, let's keep going with that. But, you know, so they don't always recover. And it amazes me that people don't do that. But the reason I think, Mitch, they don't is they just simply don't know where to start, or they're either oblivious or choosing, be very careful my wording here, choosing to ignore the elephant in the room. I know that could happen, but I don't want to think about it. And if you go in with that level of optimistic rose-tinted glasses, it can be a very expensive experience for you. So, okay, so what am I going to do if this happens? And doing it before you get into the investment is crucially important. I think we're probably going to run a bit longer with this because I think there's so much value in this particular stanza of what we're talking about. Because once you're in the heat of combat, whether it's on the footy field, you know, you think about playing footy and someone gives you a backhander, your natural instinct as an alpha male is to give them one back, which is going to see you off the field.
That's right.
Which is why they did it in the first place, to get the reaction from you. And if you don't have that level of emotional control, your team's going to finish the game a player down and they're going to lose. Investing is the same. If you feel that reactionary kind of, I'm not having that, it's all over for you because your decision-making has gone totally away from what the structured plan was to this impulsive red brain disaster management, fight or flight, primal reptilian brain part of your head, which you've got no business making decisions with. So you've got to make those decisions early on and then have the discipline to stick with it. So psychologists call it the endowment effect. When you own something, you feel differently about it. So if you own BHP and it dropped to $16, which it has, and you go, what do I do? You know, I'm going to better get out of it before it's too late. And you get out at $19 and you see the thing's up at, you know, $50 now. It wasn't a good decision. Whereas if you had a more strategic plan that said, look, if it starts to fall and it falls below this level, something we call a stop loss, I'm just going to get out here. And if it continues to fall, I'll look for a buying opportunity. And you got to have the discipline to buy back in then, of course, to buy back in because I've not only missed that potential loss I would have made, bigger loss, but I've got the opportunity to pull it up as catch up as profit rather than waiting for it to get back to break even. And that's how active, or I'm going to say smart traders would work. That's a stop loss. You could buy insurance, which a little bit more sophisticated, using a put option. But again, that's not something the rank and file everyday mum and dad investor can do. Certainly financial planners don't do it, and most fund managers don't either, because it's hard to know when's the optimal time to buy insurance. It's certainly very easy to rattle off the dates as we have earlier in this podcast and go, well, that you should have bought then, you could have bought then. But in the reality of trading, it can be quite challenging. You know, most recently, if I look at trade I had on NAB, when the Israel-Gaza conflict started, when that kicked off, my experience told me that that's likely to be quite gnarly for markets for a few days because of it being in the Middle East. And it's got the potential, given the religious basis of it all in that region, that it could really spiral out of control very quickly, which is definitely not good for markets. So just buy some insurance now anyway. And it was expensive to buy because insurance is always expensive during times of emerging crisis.
Yeah.
But for the peace of mind that it offered, it just meant that, okay, I've got no more downside. I sacrificed some income and it was a net neutral, marginally profitable, net neutral sort of effect. But my downside was covered. And that was a decision I was able to arrive at very quickly because I've got 30 years of muscle memory of going, it's about to hit the fan. You better get sorted out now because it'll be worse tomorrow.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas I think less experienced investors would go, I'll give it a day to see what happens. Oh, gee, that's worse than I thought. And you're chasing it. So the notion of buying insurance to protect is a higher level of skill, which I just don't think is fair to expect from an everyday investor that hasn't had specialist training. Okay. So that's a way. I think, yeah, if you've got alternate investment strategies running too, where you've got exposure to other asset classes, you know, in a correction, a rising tide lifts all ships and a falling tide lets you see who's swimming in the nude, I suppose. But that ability to switch into bonds at a time when equities are coming off as all the money flows from equities, which are perceived as a riskier asset, into bonds, which are safer, can give you a sort of, not a get out of jail, but the ability to swing your money quickly from one side of the board to the other. But again, that's a high level skill to, now you know it, you just listened to the podcast, but to know exactly how to do that and to have the confidence to do it in the midst of something that's quite challenging is hard. These are hardcore money management skills, and most people don't have those skills, either because they don't know what to do or they don't have the mental hardness to stick to their plan. And actually, that's why you wrote the plan, so in case of an emergency, you knew what to do rather than all these feelings of, oh, it feels like this or it could be. Just get on and stick to what you said you were going to do in the cool light of day. That's why having a trading plan is essential.
Indeed. Now, the recovery, AB, the fun part, because herein lies plenty of opportunities. And as you say, signal screener post-COVID, you know, we called a bullish market and saw extreme amount of upside from that point onward. Sometimes the best opportunities can be after a crash. And it's really two that come to my mind. value stocks, stocks that have been absolutely punished, are trading on low multiples or high volatility from an options perspective? How do you see things?
Look, in theory, again, retrospectively, you can go, oh yeah, that would have been a great time to buy. And I'm really proud of what your team, the Quants team, put together as well with our signal screener, because it did let us get back into the market through that February period in 19, which was really close to the low. And people are looking at you going like, what? What are you doing? This is a collapse. And it's never a collapse. It was what it was, which was pretty aggressive. You know, pop your eardrums on the way down. Ooh, yeah. For sure. But it's never going to zero. There'd be a few people that probably put a comment below that go, it will, it's a fiat's going out the window and the new order's coming or whatever. But, you know, the reality is it's not going to zero. And so I liken it to those firemen and emergency responders during 9/11 that ran toward the building and in the building and up the stairs when it was on fire, when everyone with a brain was going the other way. And that's not to say they're not brainy. That's to say that their commitment to what they were there to do overshadowed any emotional feeling. Now, if you put that in a trading context, it's exactly the same insofar as, it's not exactly the same, but you get the analogy. In a market correction, it feels like the last thing you want to do is start buying. But if that analytical brain and purpose and skill set overshadows the emotional reaction, you can do that. Now, I'm not saying you're going to put everything in the market in one go, but you can start to pyramid in your entry. So a little bite here, a little bit more of a bite in a week, another bite in another week, and gradually add your entries in at those lower levels can be very, very lucrative, but very, very hard, again, for the layperson to be able to actually implement. It's not an easy thing to want to run towards the flames. And so that reaction post-correction is the right reaction if you have the right skill set. What triggers do you use? Well, we've got signal screener here. Nice thunderstorm going too.
Yeah, I wonder if our listeners can hear that.
I don't know. Be another correction coming if the thunderstorm. And, you know, there are other things. So, for example, basic layering of indicators can really help you there. So one of the tools I like to use for finding oversold stocks, like everybody else that knows how to use a chart, is Bollinger Band. So when you get a breakdown through the lower Bollinger Band, yeah, that's not an opportunity to buy, but it is an alert saying this has been oversold. It's moved very, very quickly down. What I then like to couple it with is an on-balance volume move higher. So if my on-balance volume goes up through, say, my 10-day moving average, what I've got there is one set of indicators looking at price, which is my Bollinger Band, and it's going, look, this has been hit really hard. And then on the on-balance volume, I can see where the buying pressure from a volume perspective. So I'm looking at two different things. I'm not looking at price and price, or I'm looking at price as one metric and volume as another. Put them together and it's quite powerful. And that can start to give you an idea of where the big institutional money is starting to flow in. Because as individual investors, we're never going to move the market and you're never going to be first in. You don't want to be first in, but you can start to coattail that institutional flow, which kind of makes sense. Why? Well, that's what institutional traders do. I know, because that's what I did and that's what they do and that's what they teach. So if you learn to read those signals, all of a sudden that emotional noise and seeing Koshy and the news presenters coming on and another down day on Wall Street, and it's just, you know, pension funds have had billions of dollars or trillions of dollars wiped off, you're instead looking at this going, wow, great value opportunity coming here. And it's time to start pyramiding in using maybe something like that plus other things as a technique. Now, on a much simpler metric, I was in Canberra a couple of weeks ago and I sat down and had a coffee with a really good friend of mine. He's been a client for a number of years. One of the most diligent I know, insofar as every single month without fail, he will, Stu, you know, I'm talking about you, will send me through an email with his spreadsheet of his results every single month without fail. And I love that accountability. And we were just yakking about different things. He's had a really good back end to last year. And we're talking about just different types of systems that we use. And he's got actually quite a straightforward system that ensures that as he starts to get to these overvalued levels pre-crash cursor, he starts taking money off the table. He's not got the FOMO, let's put more money in because this thing's off to the moon. But that's where he's gradually starting to pyramid out of trade. So by the time the market gets to that exhaustion phase, he's actually almost exclusively sat in cash. And then on the way down, he's got his buying triggers exactly as I've described going back in. Now, he's been very successful over a large number of years as a self-directed investor doing that. So this isn't hedge fund institutional trading stuff. You can do this. But what I really respect about him is his discipline, because he does it. He doesn't sometimes do it. That is his jam, and he gets it right.
That's right. The psychology about this is really the main thing. Really, when we draw it all together, that's what it's all about.
It's like everything. It's a mindset. And if you think you can, you can. And if you think you can't, you're right. It's as simple as that. And I know it's an overused cliche. And then but what about this? Or how about that? Or, oh, yeah, you blokes are just talking about, anyone could talk about this. We've lived and breathed this stuff. We've done it. We've got people that trust us with large numbers of millions of dollars to do this. And we bring a level of experience and expertise that enables us to have an emotional detachment from it, because it's a skill. It's not a feel for the market, and it's not this knee-jerk reaction. It's based on a lot of experience. And the psychology or mindset behind that is crucially important. As I said before, it's harder to manage other people's money than your own because of the weight of responsibility that comes from that trust. And so if your psychology is not rock solid on a pullback like that, and you're about to help clients get exposure to a market, and you go like, yeah, but it's been falling, it's good value, and it's going to get, you know, and then this is the start of our entry. It takes enormous, enormous fortitude to want to hit that go button. And, you know, let's say the market comes down another 7 or 8% after your first entry, that belief that that was entry number one out of maybe five that you're picking up on the way down, and you've got to wear the heat when the client calls and says, hey, we just started to get into this. Why are we getting in here? It's still falling. And you've got to explain that it's a process, that you're never going to get the bottom, but you want to be getting in near the bottom. And whether it's on slightly this side or on the other side, it matters not, but it's a heck of a lot better than being holding something that's right up here at the top, putting more money in because you're frightened of missing out. That FOMO is what will kill you in markets. And then once you've burned yourself with that fear of missing out, it's then the fear of being wrong, which is a slap across the face for so many people as you watch your decision-making go out the window and drop like a stone, and your ego is in tatters, and so is your account. And you go, well, where do I go from here? That's really hard to deal with. Indeed. And that's why it's important to have people around you that can give you straightforward coaching and get you back on the rails and say, this is what we do in this situation. Yeah, that just sounds like it's the opposite of what I should be doing, and it's because it's right.
That's right. AB, thanks very much for your insight today. Nice long one, but great value today. Thank you so much.
Absolutely appreciate it. And who knows when the next one is coming, but now our listeners have got an opportunity to understand the kind of remedial steps that they need to take. Key thing, get rid of that emotion, don't panic, and have a proactive game plan and the self-discipline to stick to it.
Done. Thank you.
Pleasure. There you have it, guys. Please do us a huge favor. Share this podcast with anybody that you know that invests in markets so they can get access to this great content. As always, please do give us a review and a rating, and we'll look forward to hosting you next week.